Yeah, like I'm the entertainment man. I don't know what you want.
Exactly. Throw my hair back and forth.
Oh yeah.
Oh no, it's whip my hair. Whip. No.
You don't know how much that song gets stuck in my head. Like,
You're welcome.
Yeah. So, this is gonna be great. I sing it when my cat's tail. Look,
it took me early. Danielle, that's a medical emergency.
You need to call someone about that. I don't know who.
Can
you wiggle
it? Can I wiggle it? Oh, I can do more than that, but anyway.
You're doing some tricks?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
No, it's my cat.
Pin the tail on the Danielle.
Oh, my God. Party idea. Oh, God, it's my 30th birthday this year.
Danielle, drop your pants. We have some rings to get on there.
Oh, I'm disturbed by this conversation.
That escalated very quickly.
Look, no, what I was actually going to say was my cat's tail, when it wags very violently sometimes, and so I'll go, I whip my tail back and forth because I think I'm cool.
Just like when you're at home alone by yourself with the cat.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and even just whips the cat back and forth.
Honestly, right. she's with me right now, so she can't really speak to defend herself, but she bites me all the time, so, you know.
So maybe, it's worth the punishment.
Yeah, you know, but anyway. Yeah. All right, cool. Welcome, everyone, to Books as Bad as Twilight. Can that be our intro?
Oh, yeah, sure. Talking about your tail.
Why not?
Yeah. We tend to just kind of jump into it instead of having a proper intro because, again, professional podcasters.
I think
like some
already.
Podcasts, they have like a vibe where like it's like dead silence and they jump into the pool like a cannonball kind of thing. And that's like, bam, the episode started. That was like, we kind of dipped our toes in and like waded in the shallow end. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there you go.
Like
Yeah. No, it's we're like standing waist up, but we don't want to go in because it's still cold.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I know the feeling. It sucks.
But, it's the worst.
You know?
You authors and your analogies or whatever the fuck they're called.
You're like, I'm already sick of it.
I'm already done here. Goodbye.
Ugh. Metaphors and similes.
Ugh, they're the worst.
That was a segue, guys. Like, pick up what I'm putting down.
What?
I was letting Danielle do it. I wasn't trying to jump in.
Wait, what?
You can jump in. I said you authors and your what did I
say? Similes and metaphors?
Yeah, exactly.
No, I said but author whatever, being the segue, right? Exactly. I'm with you, Brittany. I was following Brittany.
See, I'm not. I'm totally on the other end of the room. Like,
I was just about to say you need to take some improv classes, but I've never taken any, so that's not even a fair point. Well, you just suck.
You'd be good at improv. I would suck at improv. I don't know about you, David.
I think I would land in the middle. I think I'd be perfectly serviceable, but no one would ever come to watch my show.
You know, it's really funny. We still said there's a segue, and no one's talking about it.
Hey, what's up, guys, folks, listeners?
Danielle, I feel like you should introduce David because you've known him much longer.
Much longer, yes. Today, we have a very special guest with us. We have author DC McNeil, also known as David, author of Maynard Trigg. Wait, I got the book in front of me. Maynard Trigg and the Creature Beneath the Veil. Welcome, David.
There you go. Thank you so much. It feels weird to be welcomed after that good 20-minute ramp-up, but I do appreciate that.
We do things backwards here, so you're welcome.
Are you loosey-goosey now?
Yeah, I'm feeling a bit limbered up. I was saying to you guys before we hit record that, I was kind of... I've spent the whole day basically relaxing by myself. I haven't really spoken to many humans, so I wasn't really, like, you know, in the talkative mood, but I feel like I've limbered up a bit. I think I'm ready to go.
Good. Doing your squats, your mountain poses, all that type of shit.
Hip flexes and the back.
How the fuck do you flex a hip?
It's like a thing. It's really painful.
Oh, God, don't do that.
It's good for your back. Well, no, it's good for you. It's good for, like, your back and your, like, your leg muscles and stuff. You got to be, like, stretching those hamstrings. Yeah, all that.
Got it.
You gotta be doing that every morning, man. You gotta keep everything kind of loosey goosey. It's good for you.
I was gonna go right into the inappropriate zone, but I don't know you well enough, so I'm just gonna reel right back.
You know, it's funny. Next time, well, I don't know if we'll do this, but we should totally bring Tatiana on a recording with David, like just to make things more spicy, like even more spicy.
My God, all the accents.
Wait, what is Tatiana? What's the what accent have we got there?
She's Russian. From Russia. Yeah.
Oh hell yeah.
No, it's funny because she doesn't even like. She said to me like. She doesn't view, I mean, obviously nobody views himself having an accent. And I've told her, like, yes, you definitely have an accent. She's like, what? Is this real? Yeah. Like,
oh, really? I hear mine every time I open my fucking mouth. Every goddamn time. Every fucking word I say, I hear my accent. It's awful.
Yes, we have late night David with us.
Yeah, perfect. This is late night. This is up late. This is NPR. Settle in. Grab yourself a whiskey. I know it's morning for you guys, but grab yourself a whiskey anyway.
Hey, listen, this is what it is. I can have an Irish coffee right now.
There you go. Put some Baileys in it.
Screwdriver. We have orange shoes, so maybe.
Ooh, the wheels are turning.
It's frankly the only way to talk. That was like a Sherlock moment. Like, you know, you like look around the room and you start to see all the ingredients and it's coming together.
Well, I did look around the room.
Yeah, I thought so.
I'm inside my mother again. The looking around the room.
Yeah, I mean that's look. It's late here. I don't know what to tell you. We can blame that for why it was a sloppy start if you want.
There you go.
It's not. This is actually how we start every goddamn episode.
Yes,
so
welcome.
It's fine.
Welcome. Yeah. To welcome. <again. laughs>
Yeah. If this was a twist for you, you must have just subscribed.
Yeah.
All right. So let's jump into this, David.
Yeah.
You're an author.
I am. One of the many things I do, but it's how I self-identify. Yeah.
I was also going to say you're a podcaster. What else is there? I know you have
media critic.
Media critic, producer. In my day life, I work in HR and software.
I didn't know you had a day job.
Yeah, I have like
that
a human.
Sucks.
it's why I like my day job though. But
well, that's you good. Know,
yeah.
That's a lot of pressure though, because you are. Again, because like you're producing a second book to your Maynard, and so that's a lot of pressure, and you're pretty young too. So having
are you trying to psych me out? I don't
know. No, I'm saying like that's awesome. Like you're young, independent. You have all these side projects. You're producing a second book. Like that's a like good for you. That's a lot of energy and time.
Yeah,
and then assuming alcohol.
Yeah, no, thank you. I don't know. Yeah, I've always been like kind of internally motivated in that way, I guess. Like even when I was younger, I kind of knew that I really liked writing and storytelling, and that's kind of where the podcasting stuff also came from. But it was like I also knew I needed a job that could get me a salary so I could afford to do that stuff and eventually build that into a career. So it's always just been like the diet of my life has always been work during the day to make enough money to make the things you want to do, like the art, good enough. Because a big part of it is like you have to spend money on like editors and artists and like other people to do stuff that you can't do. You know what I mean? So I don't know. I've just always been like that.
Good for you.
Yeah, that is way amazing because you do a lot. Oh,
yeah,
sorry,
it has consequences, but like there, yeah, it's hard. It's hard work and it's great, but it's like obviously, you know. There are things that you have to let go by the wayside to make it happen sometimes, but it is what it is.
I mean, I can definitely that's why one of the things that's great about doing this podcast is that Brittany and I like we do get to have like sort of a social life together. Like because we don't live close, like so we don't get to hang out as often as we would like. And it's almost like, you know, we have to get together to record the podcast so we get to spend time with one another while we're doing this. So
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. A common comment from my friends is like, what project is David going to bully me into being a part of next so we can hang out more? Which I find personally offensive, but also accurate.
I mean, like, what are friends for if you can't bully them into doing things?
If you can't put them in your content, why have them?
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. That's, can you tell my friends that?
Print that on my gravestone.
Yeah.
You say you put them in your content. Are there your friends in any of your writing? Like any people that you know?
In the novels themselves, you mean? Like am I looking also?
Is Abby based on anyone?
It's an interesting question. I think it's hard because obviously every author wants to say, no, they're all like original, but you draw from inspiration and stuff. I know certain characters are based on certain people. So like, for instance, Von Bloom is very much like a Matt Smith type. Like, I could see that in my head as like, that was a clear source of inspiration for me. Whereas like someone like Abby, I guess, who is this seemingly young, very experienced, very worldly character. I guess I was kind of drawing on like the people I grew up with. So yeah, I don't know if it's anyone specific, but I definitely steal ideas and archetypes of people I know. And then, you know, let the character kind of take on its own nuance. Like I wouldn't ever intentionally like wholesale be like, okay, this is, you know, this character is Danielle. But they have a sword now. It's more like
that would be really awesome. Danielle, get a sword.
We can just get you a sword amazing. Though. Like we can just do that. But it'd be more like, okay, you know, I know someone who's a kind of introverted mathematician or something like that, and then I base a character off that and then develop a backstory within the world. Like, I don't know. I don't think I have the skill to capture the nuance of a real person. So I instead choose to, like, let the world do the work for me in some ways.
Well, building off of that, two things. One, I do have a sword. Okay, it's a Minecraft sword.
I hate you. I hate you so much.
Oh, wait. I have a Minecraft pickaxe.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Both yeah. unfriend immediately.
It's a diamond sword, too, so...
I have it. Oh, mine's just an iron one. I have it for my friend's toddler. That's what I tell people. It's really for me.
I sit here and Kevin and I have literally a bin full of swords and daggers that were given what to the us.
Fuck. Given to us? What does that mean? From who? And why? Hey, Danielle, I suddenly feel really unsafe.
We can kick her off. It's fine.
I have a closet full of guns, too. Whoops.
Oh, my God.
Well, you do live in America.
Exactly.
Ba-dum-bum.
No, they're decorative swords. Like, you know, the stupid, like, ones with the metal dragons on and, like, all that type of stuff.
You could probably still kill someone with them, though.
Most likely.
If you tried hard enough.
Yeah. It's more of a blunt weapon at that point.
Sorry, Danielle. I steered us off course. You were going somewhere before.
No, you are perfectly fine. You're the guest. Look, you can steer us any way you choose, but...
Don't say that. Then you're going to regret that.
Yes, please, everything.
Well, I was going to ask, so you're talking about how, like, maybe certain people influenced your characters. What about just mm-hmm. other works of media? Because this, I got a real Treasure Planet vibe from this, and I wanted to know
yeah.
what kind of stories or even writers influenced the book.
It's funny you say the Treasure Planet thing. A lot of readers have provided that same comparison. I didn't think about Treasure Planet even once when I was writing it, which is so interesting to me. Yeah, it just the vibe, the swashbuckling stuff, the age of the character. Apparently, like, I guess just all of that, you know, is a parallel for that story. But yeah, I don't ever think about Treasure Planet, which I think is probably like how the rest of the world feels about Treasure Planet, much to the creator's behoovement. But other works of fiction, I mean, a big influence for me always is the books, the kind of the fantasy stories I grew up reading. In particular, like I think the Dark Tower series from an aesthetic perspective. So rather than like tone or character, just like the aesthetic mm-hmm. of the world where... those stories take place in this great kind of sprawling mid-world where it's this blend of like fantasy and cowboy and also like post-apocalypse. And I think a lot of that stuff appealed to me as a kid because when you grow up in Australia, you kind of like, you exist in like this bubble of this other society that doesn't really like, it's hard to explain, but like it doesn't, the rest of the world is so vastly different to the way that we just exist. And I think that's why I was always attracted to those stories of, like, the really high fantasy stuff that influenced me. Or not high fantasy, but, you know, weird fantasy, I guess. Because it felt more realistic to my experiences, which is these big open spaces. And you know, Australia at times feels, if you go out into the outback, and I've driven across the country, like, you go out to the outback and it's sort of it feels like an alien planet in a lot of ways. And I think that for me is what drew me in when I was a bit younger. And so when I was looking at writing this story, I'd done a bunch of really hardcore fantasy, like talking like George R.R. Martin level, like hard fantasy bullshit before this. And none of it was any good, obviously. And so when I was looking for like the inspiration of like, what kind of story do I want to tell? The Sky Pirate thing is what kicked it all off. And I think a big part of that came from the Edge Chronicles, which are Paul Stewart and Chris Riddle. So Paul Stewart is the author and Chris Riddell does the illustrations. And they're like very, very young adult fantasy. Like, do you know what I mean? Where it's like pitched at like, you know, 12 to 13 year olds.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that, but very like totally different to obviously like my book where things get grim. But the thing I took away from that was that sense of not adventure, but the idea of like, what if you did have this level of like technological complexity of, you know, ships that can fly and that combined with that Dark Tower idea of like this world that's kind of moved on from things, plus like the isolationism that I grew up with in Australia, where it's like these people live on these dissonant skyports. It was one of those things where it's not till now talking about it and having looked back at it and having had these discussions with readers and fans and stuff like that, that I've realized that is where all of those ideas came from. I don't necessarily know at the time that I was like going into, I didn't lay these things out as concepts I wanted to explore. They just said like, these are the things that like percolated through my childhood and obviously are things I, you know, subconsciously needed to talk about.
It's interesting how you cite the Edge Chronicles and also the Dark Tower series, which is a Stephen King series. And they're obviously two very different genres and very different audiences. And I also saw somewhere that your book was described as Harry Potter for adults. And it's interesting. Yeah. It's interesting combining both a coming of age novel, because these feel like coming of age book to me. Yeah,
definitely.
Personally.
Definitely. I mean, it's buildings Roman to a T structurally. Yeah.
Yeah, and but that's typically saw as a YA genre, the coming of age. So what elements do you feel really captivate the adult reader? And how hard did you find it to, what's the word? When you're crossing, it starts with a T, transverse? Is that the word I'm looking for?
Traverse.
The two genres. Yeah.
Yeah.
How difficult was it to essentially combine two unrelated audiences, really?
Really fucking hard. I'm not going to be modest. Like, it was fucking difficult. And I relied very heavily on beta readers and my editor. Brief aside, then I'll elaborate on that thought. The original work that I submitted to my editor and my agent was upwards of 2 million words.
Mm.
This book is maybe
My God, I was drinking a coffee when you said that. Holy shit.
This book is maybe like 45,000. I can't remember. It's very short for a novel. And the whole process was like titrating and looking for a story amongst all of those words. And we eventually found, this is my favorite log line for this whole project. This whole book came from a single sentence in that 2 million word manuscript. The sentence was something like, Maynard, you know, climbed aboard the ferry and stayed there with, you know, the thieves and politicians for the next 2 weeks. Something as simple as that. And I remember at the time, the very, very weird meeting where I'd driven out to my editor's flat. And at the time, he was sort of living in like the most typical share house of all time. And we've gone into his like little bedroom and we're kind of talking about it. And what's, you know, what his opinion is of the manuscript and what he thinks we should be focusing on. And he sat me down and he goes, I just need you to listen to me really carefully and not totally freak out. But you need to write a novel from this sentence.
Mm.
And that was one, because what he'd identified that was the thrust of the story was this journey for Maynard from Carthage aboard the ferry is, you know, him, it's his coming of age, right? As you aptly pointed out before. But complicated by the fact that it's in this world of people that, like, don't really treat children as children. They kind of treat them as tools or tokens or just, like, as adults. Like, there isn't really a concept of childhood in this world in the same way that we would sort of expect to find it in ours. And that was sort of similar to my childhood as well, because of the circumstances that I grew up, where I was a single mom and all sorts of other material reasons for that. But when it came to taking the coming of age narrative and finding the adult kind of, I don't know, I guess like affixing the adult stuff, like, you know, there's a bit of horror early on and kind of threaded throughout with the Seeker, which was just a real joy to write. I think the politics in particular is the thing that I find very adult and complex to unpack, where it's like, even though it's very basic class structures aboard the ferry, even within that, there are so many like complicated interpersonal and political relationships at play, that the process of bridging them was sort of, there's always a question at the heart of every story, or there's a idea at the heart of every story that I'm working on that is the central focus. And to bridge all of those gaps, use that central focus as your sort of like connective tissue. So in this case, it was, in this story, the real question that's posed to Maynard as a character is like, what are you willing to do? What morals are you willing to sacrifice in order to survive and get the answers you're looking for? And one thing he's adamant about is he's like, you know, I'm not a thief. I'm not this malcontent. I'm not a ne'er-do-well. Like, I don't lie. I don't cheat. I don't steal. And he spends the whole novel berating the hand and the thieves for this exact reason. And when it came to connecting everything, it was like, okay, well, what if you had a character who proposed themselves as very sincere and wanted the best for you, but they were sort of manipulating you and lying behind your back? And then what if you had an honest thief who, you know, as the story progresses toward the end, I'm not going to spoil it yet, but like, you know, obviously toward the end, there's that the twist with his character. All of it was about that central question of like truth and moral, and that helped connect those really dissonant like coming of age elements of who do I trust in high school. You know, when he goes to the dining room table, it's like trying to pick a high school clique to join. Do you know what I mean?
Where should I sit at the lunch table?
It's basically just mean girls.
It's just mean girls, but more complicated. Okay, yeah,
gotcha.
Kind of. Yeah, I mean the second book is way more Harry Potter-esque in a lot of ways, in the sense of like it's set in the school. So I think the first one, it was a lot harder to connect those ideas, but I think structural theory, a great editor, and just like really always bringing it back to that central premise and the central sort of themes I was exploring ended up being the way to do that. And I hope effectively, and you know, from readers' responses, I think it worked, but it was always it's always a concern that you're not going to please either party. I kind of think of it like Toy Story, where like Toy Story is like really great as a kid because it's like fun, and you watch it as an adult and there's like tons of sex jokes and stuff that you miss as a kid. I kind of think of it like that, but from a drama perspective.
There you go.
I have Danielle, I don't know if you want to jump in with a question, but I have a prepared question that relates to everything you just said.
Go for it.
So you talk about the complexity of your characters and how earlier you were talking how the story a lot of times drives what your characters will do and their personality traits. So the question I have is which character in your first book and second has your favorite character arc?
That's a great question, Brittany. That's a really good question. Damn,
son. Shit.
I'm like, that's a crackling question.
Ooh, see, I should have sent that to you beforehand.
No, that's really good. My favorite character arc, I think. Look, my favorite. I'll start with my favorite character, if I might, because that will help me think my way into an answer. If that's is that permissible?
Oh yeah, I don't give a shit.
So like, I really. I really, really liked writing Von Bloom in the first book.
Mm.
He's just this like toffee, swanning nonsense man. And I just really like how like he's just really into maths and like just... He's just a big dork that thinks he's very cool and like sophisticated. And I just like vibe that pretty hard. But he was a fun character because he doesn't have an arc. Like he's the same. And that's pretty fun. Like obviously Maynard has the most important arc in book one, which is like, you know, his realization that to survive, he's going to need to become a thief and a liar. He's going to need to become the thing he didn't want to be. But in doing that, he obviously realizes that he doesn't want to be the same version of that as Spigot. I think... The character whose arc I like the most, and I'm going to stick to book one because I don't want to talk book two spoilers, but I think definitely, like, I really like Abby and her arc. Mm. I like that she goes, because it's much more subtle than Maynard, but like, he has this obvious transformation. Abby kind of goes from doing a job, whether that's as the fairy guard or as this sort of insurgent on behalf of... It's revolutionary, and then, you know, later we learn that it's more complicated because it's also driven by this sort of this other political Crucible. Entity that the Crucible, exactly. But she's really interesting because as the story goes on, she kind of lets herself care about Maynard a bit, and they kind of develop, like, even though it's not really a friendship, like they kind of develop a bond, and she sort of has to let herself be a bit vulnerable to the fact that This kid continues to surprise her every time she thinks she hasn't pegged, and every time she thinks he's not competent enough, he manages to kind of, you know, get through by the skin of his teeth. Obviously, every time he gets through by the skin of his teeth, it makes things worse, because that's obviously progressive complication is how stories work. But, like, I really liked that she kind of, by the end of it, like, she sort of, they seem like the duo. They're like, kind of, they have the strongest core dynamic. Even though he sort of is still struggling to trust her. I really like the way that arc played out. And I think the resolution of that, where it's sort of the three of them, Mooney, Maynard, and Abby, I really like the opportunity that presented to explore in book two has been one of my favorite things to write, I think, ever. And I'm really excited for people to get their hands on book two and explore where that relationship goes next and where that sort of mentorship goes next.
Well, speaking of that, like, throughout the novel, it's definitely clear that you have a really good grasp on your characters and the world. And I'm wondering how you, because I know, like, as somebody who's never written a novel but has tried to write a novel quite a few times, I know that it can be very easy to sort of kind of throw all your eggs in one basket at one point. Like, how do you restrain yourself when you're writing to make sure that you're pacing everything correctly and setting it up in the way that you think will work, especially for future books?
I think everyone has like different processes. I think if you asked Stephen King that, he would say, get really good first readers. I'm pretty sure his response would be like, because I know his wife for him is like his first reader. She would have an intuitive understanding of his work, come back and be like, nah, this is bad, fix that. I know that Neil Gaiman would say, you need to sort that out yourself before someone else sees it. My kind of personal journey with that has been, you got to read a lot of storytelling theory to get the intuitive understanding of how to kind of restrain yourself. Then the other part of it is you need to find people who will tell you when you're not being restrained and tell you when you need to dial it back. But that leads to this complication, right? So as a storyteller, you're telling your story and it's your ideas and your narrative. And what you don't want is someone to turn around and say, okay, well, this isn't restrained enough for the story I think you're telling. And you turn around and you say, okay, well, actually I'm telling a different kind of story than that, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why you need an editor who, like, so I'm blessed, and I will say this as many times as I humanly can in as many places as I can. I have the greatest editor on the planet, Aaron, he just gets what I'm doing. We have a dynamic where he just understands what I'm trying to achieve. And both of our goal is to get us to the best version of that idea. Not necessarily the thing I was trying to do in the first place, but whatever the thing becomes, making sure that it's the best possible thing I'm trying to do. But in the process itself, like, I'm really bad at being restrained. Aaron very typically describes my writing initial process, so like the first few drafts as like a hummingbird, where I sort of like I smell the nectar or whatever, and then I just like I like fang through the forest, you know, like bouncing off all the other trees and like knocking shit over and like getting in the way of everyone else, and then eventually I get to the nectar. And then our goal is to try and trace the straightest line from the nectar back to where I started. And that's really our editorial process when it comes to structure, is aligning that journey to be like the most succinct, coherent, stylish, and hopefully entertaining as well. So it's a real balancing act. I don't have like a short answer to how I've done it, aside from making sure that I know what I want to do and then not letting my ego or my hubris get in the way of the story also being good. Because you kind of have to balance the two, where it's like, like I'm not Tarantino out here. I'm not like, we should have a 12-minute shot of them just driving. I'm like, well, that's not, they don't want to see that. But that being said, I do push back sometimes. I think I get one a book, is what we agreed. So I get one a novel where I can push back and be like, I want to keep this in anyway. The one for book one is the scene where Abby and Maynard, it's just before the shit truly hits the fan, and they go up to like the deck of the ferry, and they like eat bread and drink whiskey or something, and they just kind favorite of like reminisce. Scenes. Yeah, it's really like I really love that scene, and it's this like really like just quiet like it was sort of a in my head. I was like, these characters need this moment of bonding before everything gets awful again. It's like the only breath in the whole book. It's the actual only scene where like someone's life isn't threatened. And even then they accidentally overhear like a conspiracy. So it's even not that like, but that was, you know, that was a scene where we argue back and forth quite a lot, where Aaron was like, well, you should definitely cut this because it doesn't progress the story. So I even actually thinking about it now, I compromised and added the conspiracy bit. So maybe he did.
But the thing is though, like you need those things for the character development, not necessarily for the plot of the story.
Yeah,
exactly. But usually what you're trying to do when you construct a scene is do the multi-purpose storytelling where the events are progressing the plot and doing the development. But the reason that scene feels like a relief and a breath of fresh air is it's just one of them. It's just character development for the most. There's like the tag at the end, which is them getting the conspiracy, but they're not happening at the same time. So a lot of the reason this novel, like a lot of the reason stories have pace and like drive is because those two things are happening at once. So you feel like the characters are changing and developing in stride with the plot developing and changing. And it's why stories can feel really kinetic and driven. And like, you know, it's why this novel like kind of just grabs you and you don't really get to let go till the end. But that one scene is like the only time in the whole story where it's just two characters sitting down, just talking about themselves and their past, and it felt really necessary to me. And that's how I balance it, I think, is when I know it feels necessary for me to do, not necessarily from a structural theory perspective or from a literary analysis, but just like it felt right to do that. And sometimes you just have to like trust your gut with that stuff.
I agree, because I would have had issue if that was taken out. Only because like there are other stories that I can think of off the top of my head that they do have that sit down and talk, you know, that you need, because it does develop the story and it does develop the character and the plot, and they were there for a reason. Like I'm not gonna say a lot because we want people to read the book, but they were on the upper decks for a reason. So it's not like they were just wandering and ended up there. So it would be different if they are wandering and ended up there and then had the conversation. But no, there's a whole reason for them to be there. So
it's interesting you say that, because that's so much of the work that you do in the editing bay is you go, we have this scene where they wander up to the deck for no reason. How can we fit that to the story? And that's most of what you do as an author, is like kind of what I was alluding to before, which is like everything has to be connected and like have a reason. Mm-hmm. And when you find the compelling, like, it's like a jigsaw. When you find the piece that fits, like, you can tell. But yeah, I do adore that scene, and I adore Abby and her arc for all of those reasons as well. Like, it's just, yeah, so much of that is so intrinsic to this novel, because it starts off with Mooney as the primary mentor, and then obviously that kind of gets handled around between Spigot, Abby, and Lady Sterling, which was really
quite
fun.
Early.
Literally, yeah. It was pretty fun, actually, because in story structure, like, you know, particularly the hero's journey, which is what this story uses, it, you know, there's this idea that, like, there has to be one, like, key mentor. Like, there has to be, like, the wizard in the forest who's like, this is, you must love, it's like the Mr. Miyagi, right? Where it's like, you have to, it's like, I really liked being able to be like, no, there's like a few, there's a few influences here. And all the mentors are kind of pulling in different directions, but they're giving him the tools that he's going to need to overcome the final test.
Now, one question I have, and this is like, so kind of sort of gearing in another direction, but I'm very interested in your title character, Maynard Trigg. Where did the name come from for that? Like, what was your, like, how did you decide on the name and all that?
That I've never been asked that before.
Well, you had that whole scene where they're discussing his name.
Yeah.
And no one's asked you this?
I'm actually surprised.
Yeah. Fun fact, just before I answer that, the that scene where Von Bloom is like, hey, did you know that your name means like this type of, comes from the name of this like type of like ore or mineral or something? Mm-hmm. Like Magan or something like that? Mm-hmm. That's like real. That's in real life. I just Googled that. That's a real thing that it. Yeah. I was like, I wonder what his name means. Cause I needed Von Bloom to like give him some shred of academic wisdom. And I was like, oh, that's what the name means. Where did the name come from? That is a great question. I think in the original manuscript. Oh, here we. Yeah, no, I know what it was. Okay, so in the original manuscript, there was in the 2 million word piece that no longer exists and is not canon. There were two like chronologies at work. So there was like a future and a past, and in the future, it was sort of like older Maynard telling a story to someone else, whilst also doing like a separate adventure. And then the past was like him as a kid, which is the story that we get in these books. And I believe the reason he's called Maynard is that the character at the time, I can't remember the original, because this was many years ago, but he needed like an alias. And I remembered Trigg with 1G is like old cowboy talk for like clever.
Hmm.
So it's like, yeah. Also trigonometry, which is very fun. But then Maynard, which is the Magan thing, which is in that story, that means like earth and strength. So it was like strong and like smart and quick was sort of the
and clever
where it kind of came together. Yeah. But as far as like when I came up with, I just know that's what it, that's like why the name is the name. I don't remember coming up with it. Which feels like an inadequate answer, but it was a long time ago.
No. This is how you spin it. You were inspired.
It just came to you. If I hate when writers do that, they're like, I woke up and it was just in my brain. It was in my brain. I just woke up and it was there.
Divine intervention.
It's all promo.
Yeah.
PR. No. Let's go.
Yeah, listen, fam. That was your agent told you to change the name because it wasn't marketable. That's what happened.
That's kind of like
so funny.
That's like when Stephanie Meyer said, "I had a dream and then I wrote it down and Twilight was born." I'm like, oh,
very sexy dream. I did also, I will confess, I did Google Maynard Trigg before we went to print just to check that no one else had already snagged that bad boy. So that's my market research.
It's a very unique name, so I highly doubt it.
Yeah. Makes it really Googleable, which is apparently good. So there you go.
Yes. That is Google-able. Very good.
That's a hard word to say.
Googleable.
Google Gaga.
It's way hard. It actually sounds like it's harder in your accent. Googleable. Yeah, it adds syllables.
Googleable.
Yeah. This is... If we had ad breaks, this is where the producer would force us to cut to an ad break.
No ad break, because I want to hear you do an American accent.
Okay, what do you want me to say? What I need a line.
Oh God, I don't know.
Let me just pick. I've got notes on my desk. I'll just read something.
Okay, sure. Here we go.
I don't want to dox any of my clients, though. Hang on. remote work. Oh boy. Remote working and mental health is so important to your well-being.
Why did you sound so sarcastic?
It's me, I don't know. That's how I sound normally.
It's so important to your well-being.
That's what Americans sound like.
Yeah, that's how all Australians sound. Just like sarcastic as shit all the time. I have a terrible American accent, yeah. I'm not good at accents at all.
I mean, to be fair, I probably couldn't do an Australian accent.
I'm not even going to try.
I feel like I've skewed your perception because mine is a really weird like mesh of like Australian, Canadian, and American. Like, it's real fucked.
Well, you also have brown hair, and according to my grandma, you should have blonde hair. So what's going on?
Yeah,
with that?
Danielle's grandma's upset that I don't have like cool surfer hair.
Your grandmother is a piece of work, Danielle. She's
funny. I've got ginger and blonde in my beard. Does that count?
I was gonna say, shouldn't you be more Australians more redhead?
No, what?
I never knew there was like a stereotype. Honestly, that. Australians had to have a certain type of hair color.
Blonde, 6'4", shredded. Balance. That's good. Yeah, that's good.
Okay, I'm generally...
Yeah, everyone here is hot and blonde. Yeah. On the beach at all times.
Oh, so it sounds like California then.
True. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I really just want to, for a second, like, I'm totally going to embarrass myself, but I genuinely want to try an Australian accent for a moment.
Oh my god, this is going to be really funny.
Okay, but I have to like make sure I don't like break into fits of laughter. Like,
oh my god, just do the American. Can I give you Oh yeah, go ahead.
I'll give you a sentence if you want that will help.
Okay.
Say, can you fire up the Barbie? Which is a sentence I would actually use in my human life.
Okay.
I'd say like, hey Ben, can you fire up the Barbie for me?
Oh, I'm so nervous. Okay.
We could just cut this and leave David's out. David's in, rather.
Well, it might be worth like embarrassing myself. It's fine.
Hey, it's never going to be as embarrassing as when Lilith and Hannah, or whatever her name, shows up.
Dorothy.
We'll tell you about
poor David's goodness. Like, all right. Wait, what was the sentence again? Something on the Barbie.
Can you fire up the Barbie?
All right. I can't even like picture it in my head. Can you fire up the Barbie?
No,
that's so bad.
Definitely not.
So bad.
Okay,
so bad.
The Queen's arrived.
So bad.
Can you fire up the Barbie?
Can you fire up the Barbie? That's bad. It sounds more British than anything, but yeah, it's bad.
It's getting closer though. Yeah.
I guess I just have to go to Outback Steakhouse more. Just kidding.
Wait, hold on. I have a great transition for this.
Ooh.
Talking about accents.
I was about to say I find that hard to believe, but you've really done well.
Are you ready? Talking about accents, you could really disguise yourself and where you come from when you take on these other personalities. You, being as young as you are and as an author working all these jobs, how do you deal with imposter syndrome?
Blind arrogance.
Blind arrogance.
I've spent a lot of my living human existence training and educating myself. Education is my answer to that. I will always be a lifelong learner. I always have been. I surround myself with people that criticize my work and me and, you know, impress upon me the want to be better. They uplift me. They push me forward. They hold me up and they say, okay, this is... It's not like criticism of like, oh, do better. It's criticism of like, I believe you can do better. Let me help you do that. And I've developed this network of people, whether that's professionally or personally, who that's what we do for each other. And so when it comes to imposter syndrome, obviously like that's a thing that everyone feels, I think, to an extent. But rather than dwell on the sense that I may not be, you know, good enough or that I'm not enough or that, you know, I'm just faking it till I make it or whatever it may be. Whenever that feeling sets in, the natural instinct I have now because of the people I've surrounded myself with is if you feel like that, seek out something that you can improve like empirically. Like, let me go read another textbook. Let me go listen to a really good podcast. Let me go, you know, go for a run, like whatever it is, like improve something else because you can't ever make yourself feel like you're enough. It just is a feeling that settles down over time. And also, like, I don't know, I made a podcast about Media Crit for 7 years. You get pretty good at, like, intuiting what is and isn't good. and that's like part of it too, is everything I've done has been in service of this. Like, you know, human resources has helped me understand people on a lot deeper level. Working in software has given me a lot of my knowledge around the way that you have to manage different humans and the way that different people kind of tick, because you work with such a broad range of people there. I ran a kitchen for 3.5 years, at Sizzler, actually. so I know how to make cheese toast.
Cheese toast?
Yeah.
Wow, so you cheese cook as well.
Grilled cheese.
I love that. Cheese toast. Yeah. Amazing.
Cheese toast. It's amazing. So, like, yeah, I don't know. Like, everything in my life, like, has been in service of, like, how can I make sure that when I'm in this position where I have something that's worthy of putting out into the world as a piece of art or a piece of work, like, how do I make sure that I'm in the best possible position to make that the best possible thing I can? So instead of sitting there and being like, man, I'm not good enough, couldn't have this been better, I go, well, whatever the next thing I make will be better because I will be in a different place and I'll be a better person by then, hopefully. Mm-hmm. So I kind of always look to the future rather than dwelling on the past, if that makes sense.
Yeah. That's smart. That's...
With varying success, I'd like to say. Some nights at 2 a.m.
Oh, that you stay up?
Yeah, some nights at 2 a.m. where you're like, I can't sleep. What if I am a fraud? It does happen still.
Yeah. I believe it. It's you know, everybody experiences it, so I totally get it.
But that's what Hunter S. Thompson discovered whiskey is for. So
exactly.
Yes.
Side note, and I might cut this little anecdote out, but since you do work in HR, I think at some point Brittany and I need to sit down with you and talk about our HR experience.
Oh my god.
At the
I think Australia's HR would be a lot better than America's HR.
I mean, in general, yeah, I'm definitely going to agree with you there. But yeah, we have one hell of a story for you, David, so.
Yeah, I can give you some. We can chat. We can chat biz profesh.
Oh, yes.
Biz profesh.
Yeah, we can just talk. Hang. We can talk industrial relations.
Oh, snap. Yeah.
We can talk people and workplace culture.
Oh, damn. Ooh.
Yeah, damn.
Damn.
Enterprise bargaining agreements.
Oh, snap, you stop it.
Okay, trying to get into that stuff. Let's
I
talk
could do this all day.
Loss statements. Ooh.
That's not HR though. That's just like
I
business.
Know, but I'm in accounting.
Invoices.
The profit should be larger than the loss. I've just done your job.
Very good.
Wow. Yeah,
you're welcome.
Huh.
Let's talk about equity.
Capital,
yeah.
I don't know. Benefit tax.
Yeah. Oh God, taxes! I hate taxes.
Oh, taxes.
When in my tax class, here we go. Here's a bit about me.
here's a deep dive. Here's an insight.
I took the same tax professor 2 semesters in a row because all of his tests were take home. A, all of his tests were online. B, and attendance was mandatory. So I would stay in the back of the class, throw out my laptop, throw in some headphones, and watch The Office while I was in class because everything I needed was at home.
Oh, my wow. God.
So that's really great. You could have just watched the class, though.
Yeah, I know, but he was an awful teacher, or so like I would have to teach myself anyway.
Yeah, or like a show that's funny. Could have been another option.
I'd like The Office. Don't you dare.
All right. There's nothing wrong with The Office. It's just a great opportunity for a drive-by. You could have said Friends, and I would have done the same joke.
Yeah,
it'd be more valid with Friends. Because Friends.
Well, okay. Letterkenny, though. Do you watch Letterkenny?
No.
I highly recommend that one. Okay. That one's a good one. It's Canadian.
Okay.
Gotcha. Anyway, that was
I've never
really
heard of it. Anyway.
Far. Okay. No. So I went through my prepared questions. Danielle, do you have any prepared ones?
No, I'm all done my prepared questions.
Oh, okay. Well, then this is just bullshitting then.
Let's
So actually, you know what? We didn't give a synopsis of the book. David, would you like to give one?
Yeah, 15 minutes your baby. In. Let's do it. Absolutely.
Well, you know what? We talked about all these characters, and now we get to understand where they're coming from.
Yeah.
I can.
Yeah, this is all part of the plan.
Right.
Baby. I could definitely do that. So the Maynard Trigg and the Creature Beneath the Veil is the first story in the Maynard Trigg saga. And it follows Maynard Trigg, who's this young kind of loudmouth, brattish son of a city councillor on a decrepit, muddy skyport called Carthage. And he goes about his everyday life making mischief for his teachers, for his best friend Nell, and just anyone who has the time to put up with his bullshit, basically. And as the story progresses, we follow Maynard sort of after a day of school, and he gets cornered by this mysterious pirate who claims to be from his past. He's this really intimidating, dangerous-looking fellow called Mooney. And Mooney tells Maynard there's this creature coming after you. And Maynard doesn't quite believe it, but sure enough, in the alley where they're sort of discussing this unidentifiable thing in a cloak comes after them, and Maynard flees back to his house. Events transpire, and together, Mooney and Maynard go in search of help to deal with this creature. And despite Mooney's insistence that they have to flee the skyport, Maynard goes to seek out some adult help. Doesn't find any, realizes the seeker is in fact dangerous, and that his father's missing, probably at the hands of this creature. And so, without much choice, Maynard and Mooney flee aboard the great sky ferry, the Harmony, in the hopes of escaping this deadly creature, but also in the hopes of getting to a place called the Crucible that might have some answers for Maynard as to why his father disappeared and just what this seeker is. And aboard the ferry, Maynard must then grapple with the various political machinations at work, the various factions that have different stake and claim over the various functions of the ferry. And along the way, he has to do the difficult work that we all do as children of trying to work out just who he can trust, why he should trust them, and what he needs to survive. And through all of this, ultimately, find out just the kind of person his father was and why he didn't know anything about all of these secret dealings.
How many times did you have to say that?
That's the first time I've done the whole thing. Did that feel rehearsed?
I'm very proud of you.
Like, I thought that was genuinely great.
Not rehearsed. No. It's just that very, like, you very much knew, like, the points to hit.
You get used. Yeah, when you do enough, like, marketing interviews, but, like, they always cut it out. So, like, it's usually for the person writing the article. They always cut it out, but, like, you kind of. Because the main thing is, like, it's getting him onto the really interesting thing about the story is, like, the inciting incident is the hook, right? It's, like, the thing that gets you, like, invested, which is, like, what is this thing chasing him? What the fuck was... What was his father up to? Like, what was this guy doing to, like, have this, like, eldritch, like, machination thing that is maybe alive or is maybe a robot? Who fucking knows? Chasing after him in the dark. It can't be hurt, seemingly. Like, it's just this, like, this terrifying machine slash ephemeral creature. Like, what is his dad, who is, a desk politician, done to have this thing follow him? And that's really, like, the central thrust. And then everything else kind of articulates off that on the ferry. And then, you know, these players happen to have, well, not happen, none of it's coincidence, they're all there, you know, they planted themselves there for this exact reason. But it seems to start with that it's coincidental that a lot of these characters know his father, and as the story goes on, we learn, like, actually this is all in place to gain the information his father had found. So, yeah. Mm. It, summary-wise.
On point.
Thank you. Thank you.
Got it.
Thank you. First time.
I will say the Seeker is genuinely terrifying. Like, just anything with kind of, like, glowing eyes. Ugh.
How do you... Actually, I have a question for you guys. Ooh, flipping the table. and you can't steal each other's answers. Don't look at each other's papers. What do you imagine the Seeker looking like?
Do you want to go first, Brittany, or do you want me?
You go first, because I'm trying to...
Well...
Like, it's been a minute since I read the book, so I have to kind of think of the description.
I mean, personally, I was going to say in my head, and I think part of this goes off of marketing, because of the ad you made, David. Mm-hmm. Partially that, but that's kind of how I pictured it anyway. I pictured him as sort of this... like a cloaked figure, that's kind of like smaller, like sort of hunched over. You can't see any features. You just see the cloak and that's it. Everything is black beneath it except the eyes. That's what I picture. And again, that could be influenced from the marketing.
Well, I don't know what the marketing is. Do you just mean the cover?
I mean, what I'm saying is, because David put an ad for the book, or the second
in
book.
In levelstorymagazine.net.
Yes.
Is that the love story? Ooh,
nice rather. Plug.
I fucked it up though.
Come on, David.
The reason I asked, it wasn't a trick question. I'm just always curious because like so many people have different ideas of it. And that was such a conscious choice when I was writing it.
When things are like mysterious for me, I always think of birds.
What?
So, yeah. when there's like supposed to be like an entity that's like kind of like creepy and kind of, I don't like birds. I guess that's what it is. but like cuz birds always like they carry disease. They have talons, they have beaks, they have beady eyes.
Yeah, they're flying rats.
So yeah. Like there's when it's not that I don't like birds. Birds are nice, but they're gross.
Yeah.
So and they're obviously like prehistoric too. Like not prehistoric. What's
dinosaurs?
The word? They're dinosaurs. Birds are dinosaurs. So
like, prehistoric was the right word. I don't. Okay. You second guess yourself, but you nailed it the first time.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. So it's when there's always like a cloaked figure, and I don't think that they're humanoid. I think they're birds, like some type of bird.
Mm.
That's really interesting. I mean, there's even reference in this story with the Devereux of the Brink, like flashback myth thing, where like the seeker in that, quote unquote, a seeker in that, is sort of described as kind of screeching and kind of swooping in, a bit more bird-like.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's probably where you got it from. You're not going crazy.
Probably.
But... So there was this really fun thing I got to do where the seeker we see in the story, like in the actual prose of the narrative way in, is this like silent, kind of emotionless, like being that seems to exist outside of our conventional understanding of like what things are. Whereas in that aside story, it's this like screeching monster menace thing that's like swooping around and moving really quickly. Whereas in the story that we experience, it's very slow and like deliberate. And so much of the way I wrote the seeker was like the evidence that we get through the prose, like the action of the story, is so commonly contradicted by everyone else's ideas of what this thing is.
Mm-hmm.
it has been and will continue to be a fascinating activity to, it's like constant misdirection where different characters have different opinions of what this like potentially mythical creature would do, you know. The reason you're thinking bird is that Hank insists throughout the whole story that he's seen this like giant bird in the Orlop, you know, this like mysterious kind of demon creature. And no one believes him. And obviously he's seeing the seeker down there consuming the all of the supplies to sustain itself. But it's like all this conflicting information. So when you ask someone, how do you describe it? They go, I don't know, because there's so many different data points.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a fun, like, horror creature in that way, where it's, like, depending on who is talking about it, it shapes the way that you start to, like, picture it. It was just a fun thing to put in the story that I think makes it more scary, because if you ask the wrong person how it works and what it is, that could probably get you killed.
Mm-hmm. It's, like, you just reminded me of a question that I had, but I forgot to write down. So if you don't mind me asking another one.
Yeah, go for it.
You're talking about like conflicting ideas and ideologies of what the seeker would be. Now, in writing, we often hear about unreliable narrators. How unreliable is Maynard?
I think where to take his experience as the canonical events.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent he's unreliable to me is less important than whether or not the events we perceive are like the quote unquote like canonical version of like the story. It's like it's Maynard, the series is called Maynard Trigg. There's probably not going to be a point where the flip gets script and it's like, okay, now we're seeing it from like this other character's perspective. It's always going to be him. In the same way that Harry Potter is never like an unreliable narrator. But obviously everything is filtered through his perspective, which is a really difficult balancing act when it comes to description, right? Because when you're a 14-year-old kid or whatever, the stuff you notice is vastly different than what you notice as an adult. Like, you don't really have an analytical eye yet, and yet a narrative, particularly, you know, a close third-person narrative, demands analytical views of things in certain circumstances to help your reader understand, like, what a broom looks like or what a person's dressed like. Mm. Whereas kids don't think about that so much. So it's actually, like, it was a really difficult balancing act of, like, less about the reliability, but more just, like, and it's something that always comes up in the edits that we go back and forth about to try and find the right way to put it, is, like, if this detail is important to this story or this character, how would Maynard perceive that detail? So it's not just, like, that they wear a belt. It's like, well, from Maynard's perspective, what would that belt look like? You know, he grew up on, like, a mudding skyport. He knows, like, one fancy person. So for the most part, yeah, in the story, in the first book at least, most of the time he sees someone dressed well, he tries to relate it to Parker, who is the fancy person he knew as a kid. Because that's how kids work. And so it's making sure that if the detail is being called out for a plot or a character reason, that it's also reflected in Maynard's perspective. Like, it's also reflecting Maynard's worldview, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also, you have, like, Abby, who, when she first meets Maynard, points out his boots. And, like, oh, you're a mudfoot. Like, you're from Carson.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, it's, like, stuff like that. That's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's a great... I love that little detail. That was a really... Because, again, she's this character who notices things. She's got that eye for detail. You know, she's familiar with these detectives and all these kind of people. She's got this kind of PI vibe, explored a bit more in book two, but yeah.
I just realized she had said that, and then Sterling misplaced Maynard when she met him.
Yes, because she gets it wrong, because she's trying to manipulate him. Yeah. Like, and that's what I mean by the conflicting data sources, where if you're reading it and you remember that Abby called out the boots and then Sterling gets it wrong, you know from jump that she's lying. Or at least that she's trying to get one up on him, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I'm grinning, by the way, because that's like that's like the stuff that I love doing in these stories. I love it. I love that you noticed that.
There you go.
Yeah. You did something right. Congratulations. Good job.
Yeah.
That sounded way more cynical than I was meant it to sound.
Yeah.
That is a compliment.
It was like the phrasing, not the tone of voice. I don't know.
David, I know you know Danielle. However, her sense of humor is so dry. It catches me off guard half of the time. It does. Wow, that could be super insulting.
I know.
That's why Danielle and I get along, because half of the shit I say is so offensive objectively. But if you know I'm kidding, because I always am, it's fine.
It is true. Oh, I will say things sometimes, and Brittany looks at me like, what?
So I don't blink. Yeah. I've some friends who, like, their husband and wife and their toddler. Actually, it was the Minecraft pickaxe kid, who I pretend is the reason I own the pickaxe. But he's got a really dry sense of humor like mine, where, like, everything is always sarcastic.
Kid or the parent?
The parent, the husband. Okay. And the wife, she doesn't necessarily, but the kid has started picking up on our sense of humor. So she can't tell when the kid's fucking with her, which is kind of amazing. Where, like, you know, she'll be like, okay, well, it's, you know, 1, 2, 3, and then what comes after that? And he'll be like, he'll, like, lean real close to the mic and be like, 5. She's like, what comes after it? And he's like, 5, and, like, grinning, and she's like, no, but I do need to know that you can count, actually. You need to confirm this for me, because I'm not sure. He's like, 1, 2, 3, 7.
I'd love this child.
He's so good. He's amazing. But, yeah, suffice it to say, that's a big part of the reason why Danielle and I get along.
There you go. You heard it here first, folks.
Hey!
Hey! There you go.
You know, I was listening to a podcast.
How long were you sitting on that?
What's that? Oh,
how long were you sitting on that?
Not very long, like literally seconds.
I thought of it and had to pop it off immediately.
Yeah.
I'm surprised you haven't made it like a network, like, legislative requirement that in every episode you have to use that pun at some point.
She does, though. We don't even have to say.
It's funny though, because I was listening to a podcast the other day and they said like, oh, you heard it here first, folks. And I thought to myself, like, that's why I say it. Cause so many other podcasts say it.
Like, no, you need to patent that or something.
Copyright it. Oh shit. Is it going to be like that? Oh, there was a thing that happened and I can't remember. So this story just doesn't make sense.
Good anecdote.
Yeah, it was basically, it was the word react. I think there was a YouTube channel that copyrighted the word react.
And they did. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what channel that was? I don't remember. I forget.
Reaction videos.
I want to say the Fine Brothers, maybe.
The Fine Brothers. I think that's it. I think.
If that's true, that is an insane memory reach for me, but it sounds right.
I think it is, but obviously that didn't work out.
Yeah, well, and they tried to DMCA other channels that were using React in the title of the video because they claimed that they had invented the format and they had a patent on it. Turns out lawyers fundamentally disagree with that as a concept, because in the same way that even though Cadbury has a patent on the color purple, other companies can use the color purple for other stuff.
Verizon's trying to do that with the color pink, like fuchsia. They get denied all the time.
That's very American. Own this. This isn't colonial times. You can't just like put your flag in it, guys.
Well, I know Coca-Cola actually, the red that they use is copyrighted. However, it's only copyrighted for other drinks. So, like, if you, like, use it for, like, a food, like, brand or something, you're fine. But if you make a drink with that color.
Penn State Blue as well.
I didn't know that. Interesting.
Yeah, Penn State
Blue. On the Coke thing, did you know that that's the reason that Santa is red and white?
Really?
It's a marketing thing that Coke did. He used to be, like, green and blue, and they made him red and white, because now at Christmas you think of Coke.
Right.
And that's capitalism, baby.
Oh,
gotta love God. It.
Fucking up family traditions to sell a fizzy drink that's killing you. Oh, isn't that,
snap.
Ain't that it? Ain't true. That what it is?
Yeah. Yep, and Santa Claus was supposed to be Saint Nick, who was absolutely destroyed just by capitalism.
Yeah.
Yeah, just mostly by Coca-Cola.
Mostly by Coca-Cola, who primarily used to actually put Coke in their actual drinks because it was sold as medicinal.
If we're being real, that sounds like a pretty good drink.
With Coke in it? Coke.
It's better than standard Coke now, if that's all I'll say. Like,
Mexican Coke is good.
Mexican
Coke. Because they have all the spices.
What?
Mexican Coke.
Is it that
drink?
Yeah, it's why. What's the difference with, like, I know there's a difference. I taste a difference, but like, what
there's
is...
real sugar and it has spices in it. Oh. Like horchata.
Oh.
Wow. Okay.
And all soft drinks here just taste like garbage because we have terrible water.
Oh no! I don't drink.
It's not that there's anything wrong with it. It's just like not good quality. for brewing drinks.
I mean, when you're speaking of like things that Coke has ruined, they're also ruining our insides. So it's probably good if you don't drink it. You know,
strips rust off of metal.
Oh yeah, you leave a piece of meat in Coke for a few days and well, that bagel will be disintegrated.
Think about. Thanks, Danielle.
Well, that's why I drink water and beer. And that's like the only thing.
I drink water, beer, and orange juice.
Mm.
But I buy expensive orange juice because I'm fancy.
That's the only way you can. All like, that. Look, I.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I've never been a huge fan of orange juice because I always got like the concentrated, nasty kind. And I went out.
Oh, no. Mine's got pulp and shit.
Well, yeah, like when you get fresh squeezed, like, because I like oranges. Like, when I was younger, we'd be at a soccer game, and I'd be having oranges on the sidelines. Like, this tastes amazing. Why can't orange juice taste like this? Well, yeah,
Hey, Brittany, did you just get the amazing mental image of, like, Brittany in, like, soccer gear on the sideline of a pitch, but, like, eating a fucking orange at, like, 12 years old? My brain just, like, imploded slightly.
That's gonna be the
I just sit here and I'm laughing at just at this. Oh, hey, we're gonna have David on, talk about his book, and, like, no, oranges.
That's why, because I can't.
For 10 minutes.
I just can't stay on topic. I'm like, let's talk about everything else.
I mean, to be fair, like, what time is it where you are, David? Is it like midnight at this point?
It's 11:30. I got heaps of time.
Oh shit.
Oh really? It is 11:30. Oh okay.
Yeah, that's not as late as I thought.
Okay.
I got time.
In case the listeners.
Before we Sorry. Yeah, before we pivot back, I'm going to grab another beer, if that's okay. If you can be two seconds.
Oh, sure. Go ahead. I'm going to take a swig of water.
Take a swig of water. Swig of orange juice.
Swig of orange juice. Put the shrimp on the Bobby.
Closer. Oh my god. Stop. This is like, so this is supposed to be like on the editing floor, like private conversation between you and I, but no, let's record it.
Sure, why not? You want me to leave it in?
We cut that part and we put it as our fucking teaser.
Ah, there you go, yeah. Oh.
There you go. Woo. Oh. The whole part of the oranges.
People be like, oh, I'm not listening to this. Oh my goodness. Oh my God. Well, and then we have to, when we're done the episode, we just have to really quick introduce David to Dorothy and Lilith.
Oh my God.
I'm back.
It's going to be so embarrassing.
I feel
like. What did I miss? Okay.
So Danielle and I, when we were recording the intro episode for After Alice, I don't know what got us so hype. we were in my dining room just making up voices and recording ourselves, and we came up with two demon voices.
Hold on. Brittany has like this demon voice, and I don't know why you started doing it, but you did. Perhaps if we like listen back to our like intro test that we were doing, maybe we can figure out the mystery. But then I was like, oh, well, you're doing your voice. Well, then let me show you my voice.
God, okay. They just escalated from there.
Exactly. Oh, we started singing Bohemian Rhapsody.
Tried to do the harmony.
You have to put that out somewhere as like an outtake.
We are actually. It's already been Halloween. Edited. It's already been edited. Like, it's like, ready.
It's on the Patreon already.
Oh my god.
So she was saying that we had to introduce you to Lilith, who's my demon, and Dorothy, who's Danielle's.
Dorothy's a bad demon name though.
No, absolutely not. I based her off.
She's more of a like a
She's based off the golden girl, Dorothy.
Who's a demon?
Dorothy. The golden girl Dorothy.
You know, Golden Girls? And also pay homage to Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz. You know, that's what you do.
Dorothy. I don't know. The Golden Girls. Like, sick on television, The Golden Girls, portrayed by No, I don't know who this is.
Really? What?
Yeah.
Well, she's pretty iconic, so I really want to
Danielle,
I
also
her.
Don't watch The Golden Girls, so.
Sorry. Okay, I'm a straight man. I choose to ignore iconic women. It's kind of my thing.
God,
it's kind of
David.
My thing.
Oh my god, really I really funny. Felt like I was channeling Schitt's Creek right there. I don't know if you guys watch that.
Sorry.
Well, wait, is that with the character David? Because I've heard that before.
Yes, like, yes. Oh my god, David.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. I had a coworker that used to do that, and I didn't know the show, and I asked her to stop doing it. She never stopped doing it. It's not why I quit, but it's a part of the reason I left.
You're like, I just don't understand.
I was just about to say, you must be so grateful for COVID. They don't have to see her anymore. But no, you quit. You just
I quit. I solved the problem. I don't do half measures, Brittany. I'm out here being Britain in fucking World War One peace talks. No half shit. No half shit. Bury Germany. What could possibly go wrong?
That was a very big analogy. I love it.
Jesus.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Sorry.
No, you're good.
I'm gonna calm myself because I'm just gonna break into fits of laughter if I don't. So here we go.
Wait, what? Oh, we're doing this now. We're not gonna talk about his second book.
No, we're not doing this now. No. Oh, okay. No, I'm just calming myself down from just talking about it because, like, if I do get into fits of laughter, I'll never recover. So
I know then you'll just leave me hanging, but I left you hanging with the Australian accent, so I guess it's fair.
True. But, you know.
So two beers in, David. Tell us what you can about your second book. Also, how far do you see the series going?
Well, does it? Okay, I can. What can I legally say? I've signed a contract for four. So, book one, book two, book three, book four. And that's probably like where I also see the story going. It was originally going to be 5 or 6, but I think with the way the story's developed over time, like 4 is like kind of the right number. Mm-hmm. What can I tell you about book 2? Book 2 is a continuation of the story, so it is a direct sequel. It follows our trio. Well, I feel like it's important to say, because it could have been like, you know what I mean?
Like, true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. Could have been like a Red Dead Redemption 2 thing, where it's like a sequel, but also a prequel. Like, there's, could have been,
Or like Beauty and the Beast, The Enchanted Christmas.
Sorry, like what, Danielle?
Like,
tell me more about that.
Beauty and the Beast, The Enchanted Christmas.
Yeah, that's a really hot reference in 2020. What a contemporary drop. People at her, listener, could you please tweet at Danielle, get on Twitter, at her directly, if you understood that reference. I guarantee 0 tweets, because who was that for?
Come on. Classic.
The direct-to-DVD sequel of Beauty and the fucking Beast.
Hey, I'm going to correct you there, son. VHS. Sequel. All right, get it right. Come on.
even more relevant.
Look, it's a terrible sequel, but come on, folks. Like, you're not gonna get this reference? Iconic. Like, come on. Anyway.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Having snort, Danielle.
What did you say?
You came very close to making him snort with
very
laughter.
Very close. Oh, I'm good. It's fine.
Damn,
I'm
so
fine.
Close. That was my mission this entire episode.
All right. Well, you'll get him with Dorothy, I promise.
Oh my god, yeah, you're right.
Listen, okay.
I don't know if I want David to see the side of myself, to be honest. But anyway, sorry, David, go ahead.
It's pulling back the veil too much.
Yeah.
What? That wasn't. I didn't.
That's a pretty good reference to the creature.
To what?
Your own book, sir.
Oh, to my novel. Yeah. That's just a turn of phrase. I didn't even connect it. Yeah. There
all right.
You
sorry,
go.
I cut you off. Continue.
That was an accidental reference. Anyway. Book 2. What I can say is that it is a direct sequel, so it's a continuation of the story, and it sees Maynard and his allies sort of seeking shelter in the Crucible, which is this kind of great school of like learning and magic, and this is sort of the place where Abby primarily is sort of contracted or employed or reports to, at least. And when they arrive, events sort of take a turn. Unexpected turn, and children start to go missing. And as this happens, the White Law are sort of closing in on Maynard and his allies after the crash of the Harmony. And so there are suddenly all of these competing factors of, the martial White Law closing in, hoping to sort of, you know, prove that they were involved in the crash of the Harmony. You also got all of these people in the Crucible who know about Maynard's father trying to solicit this information. All the while, these children are going missing. And seemingly at the heart of it all, the enigmatic Master Detector, Master Uskor, who seems to have a finger in all of the pies and eyes and ears everywhere. A man who, for all the world, it seems, knows more than he's letting on. So Maynard, once again, is forced to make his own way and try to decide who he can trust and what he can do. But ultimately, he has to decide whether this new life he's found for himself in the Crucible, this life of safety, is one that he wants, or if he's going to give all of that up in pursuit of the truth and perhaps learn more about his father. And that's sort of the thrust of the book.
Nice.
I love children endangerment, so missing children, yeah, good.
That's my favorite thing.
If you like that, then you should read The Golden Compass as well.
I mean, that's a lot of also God endangerment too.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. What, they kill God at the end? Spoilers. Anyway. spoilers. Third book. It's fine. Actually, I think Philip Pullman had a big influence on Maynard Trigg, because that first book is like hella steampunk, and I think that's where I first interacted with steampunk. I think.
Yeah.
I, like, oh, learned cool. that it was a thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd call Maynard Trigg steampunk though.
It feels like elements. It a little. Yeah, like elements, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, to me, personally.
Mm.
I was going
to
say...
I think definitely the Seeker feels steampunky, kind of.
Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah,
the metal and the skin and the discs and stuff.
It's funny because I'm actually reading through his Dark Materials at the moment, and I'm on the second book, and I guess I read Golden Compass first, and then I read Maynard Trigg, so I didn't pick up anything, but reading the second book, I'm like, oh, yeah, I wonder if he's read Philip Pullman, because I can definitely see the influence there.
You know, it was required reading for my my writing degree, but I think the thing I was drawn to with Pullman is he... His world building and his ideas are like so robust, and his storytelling for the most part is pretty good. But he's one of those writers where I'm like, if he just had been edited a little more diligently, and if there had been someone that came into that structural level and really pushed back and really said like, we could tighten this up a bit, I just think they'd be some of the best books that exist. But as they are, they're great. It's just, you start to see though, I think one of the hardest things is like, once you've been in those processes and you read other work, it's really like, not that Maynard Trigg is like objectively good or anything like that, but that you can tell it's been edited because it's really slick, and like there's nothing that stands out to you as a person who's being edited is like, oh, this is like, you know, they missed this bit. There are so many books that I read now where all I see is like, oh, the, you know, whoever did the structural editing didn't pick up on this loose end, or this sequence doesn't follow, like, you know, the 5-act structure like the rest of the book does, so it feels really incongruous, or like this valence shift is wrong. Like, you start to accidentally dissect everything you read.
Yeah. Also,
that's a hard thing to turn off.
There are times during our speaking, David, you downplay your book. I don't want to hear any more of that, sir.
Oh, do I?
Yeah. He's like, not that Maynard is objectively good, so... Enough of that.
I just didn't mean to tacitly imply that, like, I read Philip Pullman's books and I was like, and mine is better. Just like,
it's
that they're
fine
different.
It's also fine, though, if you think your own work is better than others. Just saying.
I think it slaps. Otherwise, I wouldn't have written it.
Exactly. So, yeah. No more of that.
There you go.
Also, LOL, it slaps.
It slaps.
Oh, was that...
I like it, but I'm also old, so
good.
I don't speak the lingo you kids do these days.
I can never tell when I say something that's like young and hip or what something old and crusty. Like, they're kind of the same in my head.
I was going to say, I'm older than you, and I say it slaps.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, must be an old person thing, then.
I'm trying to think of when you would say it.
I don't say it that often, but in
you
the
said,
rare moments.
I've heard your human mouth, Danielle, say...
Yeah.
Kingdom Hearts 3 remake slaps.
There we go. Wait, did I say that? I don't even remember.
Yeah, we were
that
having
the
having a discussion of
praise. I think I've ever.
That's the most white middle class thing you've ever said.
Wait a minute.
Except Trump for president.
Oh, stop.
Oh, stop it.
Sorry, we'll cut that.
Yeah. Well, was that like in one of our episodes that we recorded for Art for Artists? Is that when that is?
No. We were talking about. It was on like I think it was on one of our planning calls for Level Story, and we were just talking. You were talking about what you've been playing, and
Well, then I've said it.
I remember it vividly for some reason. It's burned into my brain.
Well, you know what? There's a reason, because Kingdom Hearts 3 slaps.
I am done.
And I'll stand by that statement till I die.
Anytime I can bring up Kingdom Hearts on anything. Look, that's what I try to force on my friends is Kingdom Hearts.
Kingdom Hearts.
Right. Mine is my novel and Dark Souls. So that's like the two.
There you
things.
Go.
Yeah.
There you go. Everybody has something. What's yours, Brittany?
I don't have anything. When's the last thing I tried to force on you, Daniel? Except being...
Bad books?
Yeah, I don't force them on you,
No,
though.
You don't, though, yeah.
Oh, I'll do a sad rom-com. I'll be like, you have to watch 500 Days of Summer. Like, I'm that guy. I'm like, you need to learn about yourself through media.
Oh,
go watch something sad.
Oh, my God. Learn about yourself. Mm-hmm. In touch with your feelings.
Well, I think that's, like, fundamentally true there, right? Like, I think we tend to read or consume nonfiction to, like, learn about the world. Like, whether it's, like, documentaries or novels or whatever. But I think that there's this human thing that we don't often acknowledge, which is that we consume fiction to learn about ourselves, because we can internalize those lessons, because we don't have the same, like, oh, this is like real life and there are rules. It's like you can kind of, like, fiction sneaks into your brain in a way that nonfiction can never do, and I think that's like the value of telling these outlandish speculative fiction stories is you subconsciously absorb and internalize the lessons that make sense for you, and you reject the other ones that don't. But it's not like learning in a classroom where someone sits you down and they say, like, this is right and this is wrong. Like, you actually, you consume these stories and you understand, like, okay, so the story is pitching Harry Potter as the good guy and Voldemort as the bad guy. Like, obviously, he's Wizard Hitler, so it's not an easy, like, it's not a hard thing to work out. But, like, other stories, it's like, this character made this decision, and the story, or the character, sorry, rather, the characters in the story judge that decision, but you as the reader internally get to decide whether or not you think that that was, like, a good or a bad thing to do. And in doing that, you internalize that lesson, where you're like, okay, actually, you know, I think that, you know, I think that we should probably treat people, like, equally, or vice versa, or whatever it is. Like, those are the lessons that you pick up through fiction that you can't just be, like, told. Like, you have to discover them yourself. And I think fiction is a medium, especially prose, because you're not distracted by my dumb voice or by music or by, like, you know, Matthew McConaughey or whoever the fuck, like, the special effects or the you know, Is it Josh Brolin? It's Thanos, whatever it is. Like, all of that spectacle fades away and you have to, like, imagine it in your head, and that's how it gets in. It's like this brainworm of goodness. I think that's why, like, people will always probably read fiction novels. Like, even after the biography is passé and everyone's life is fully documented on whatever terrifying world-ending conglomerate Facebook is going to become. Even after all that happens...
Or just podcasts in general.
Just podcasts in general. Yeah. But most podcasts haven't caused several genocides like Facebook has.
True.
So it's like, you know, they're less guilty, I guess. I'm sure some of them have. Can't prove that. But I think, like, yeah, even after we get to the point where everyone's life is completely documented from end to end and you can go through and you can see every single thing that that person did from life to death, I think we'll still have... People will still probably be reading fiction, even if it is, you know, through a chip in their brain or whatever the fuck, in the future. I just think that's always going to be the case, because it does open that avenue to self-growth and reflection that just, like, nothing else seems to be able to do. Except, like, Taylor Swift records, obviously.
Exactly.
Obviously.
I mean, without a question.
I mean, Folklore is, like, objectively her best work, but let's not get into it. Followed closely by Lover and then Red. Those are, like, the top three rankings. I won't hear anyone else or any other opinions about it.
I mean, what a good way to... I think that's a perfect way to end the show, actually, on those very inspiring words. Yeah.
Read a book, dummy.
Yeah, seriously.
was that less eloquent?
Look, you gotta say it sometimes. What's that?
Asshat.
Oh, yeah. Asset. Look, yeah. I had a professor in college who one time told us, like, what's so great about, like, fiction, particularly books, is that you can, it doesn't take much to do it. You go to the store, you go pay a dollar for a notepad, pay a dollar for a pack of pencils, and you're good, and your imagination is going wild, and no other medium can say that they can do that. And when people
I completely agree.
And people tell you that the fiction, like, books are disappearing, they're not. There's so many good books out there. Fiction is not going anywhere. So
I don't know who says that, because they obviously don't know. There's so many books.
People just like to say that. To, like, when, like, the e-reader was coming out, people were like, oh, like, the written word's going to disappear because now we have e-books and people are going to watch movies more on their e-readers and stuff. And I'm like, are they, though?
But also, like, that's all still inferior technology. Like, all of that stuff, like, runs out of power. Like, it,
right.
You can't do it in the sun most of the time. Like, all of that stuff, like, it's still not adequate technology when it's compared to a book, which lasts for a long goddamn time. Mm-hmm. You can just, like, hand it to another person. They can read it. You can open it whenever you want, as long as you have light. They're portable, small weapons if you need them. Mm-hmm. They're like they have a lot of utility. An iPad's just going to crumble, but a book you could do some damage with. Like, not that that's anecdotal, please bleep that out. I've never hit someone with a book as a weapon. but, like, they are, like, objectively, like, technology that we haven't been able to replicate, I think. Like, they're just a unique thing that's always going to exist, hopefully.
Yeah, I agree. 100%.
that and TikTok, obviously.
Oh, well, obviously, yeah. Unless it's used for American propaganda, but, you know.
I thought it was just fun dances.
Oh, you sweet summer child.
We have to end the podcast before I make another contemporary reference that's wrong.
All right. So that's it. Keep an eye out for... Well, if you haven't got it... Okay, cool. I'm not...
Yikes.
Yikes. Goodbye.
Well, David, why don't you plug your website? So where can people find you? Where can they buy the book?
People can buy the book at maynardtrigg.com. We've got all the various trappings you want there, ebooks, audiobooks, physical, anything you want. Also posters and merchandise. Now, if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at DCMIHatePie. I don't really like do social media, but that's the best place to follow me if you want to find out the projects I'm working on. I also run zeroindent.com, which is a publication about media criticism. That's all I kind of have to plug at the moment. Them's my pluggables. Maynardtrigg.com.
Nice. Yeah, be sure to buy the book, folks, because it's very good, and you should read it.
It ships internationally within 5 days. So.
Ah.
And shipping's free.
Look, you can't really get a better deal than that, then. Come on, folks. Get on it. Buy the book.
Buddy, find me one. Send it to me. Just buy the book, though. But
yeah.
Buy the book. Challenge. Yeah.
All right. Well, David, thanks for coming on our show. This was fun.
It's been my pleasure, and also I apologize.